You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President and the Director for Foreign Policy here at the Brookings Institution. It's one notch too early to say Happy Thanksgiving, but Happy Thanksgiving anyway. And thank you for being here this morning. And I'm pleased to welcome all of you, as well as to extended members of the community who are watching the live webcast of this event. My job is a simple one today. It's to welcome you and to welcome our distinguished guests here to Brookings. We're particularly pleased to welcome Mexico's ambassador to the United States, Geronimo Gutierrez Fernandez. Ambassador Gutierrez has served this position with distinction since April 2017. He deliberately chose that timing to make his life as hard as possible. Prior to his appointment as ambassador here, he had served as the managing director of the North American Development Bank, and before that held several positions in the federal government of Mexico, including as undersecretary for Latin America and the Caribbean, and was responsible for the normalization in Mexico-Cuba relations, as well as the reestablishment of diplomatic ties with Venezuela. So he's well-trained in handling complicated relationships. We're also very pleased to welcome former U.S. Ambassador to Mexico, Earl Anthony, or as we all know him, Tony Wayne, who currently serves as a public policy fellow and co-chairs the Mexico Institute Board at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Tony has served in many U.S. government and State Department roles throughout his illustrious career, notably as ambassador to Mexico, ambassador to Argentina, and assistant secretary of state for business and economic affairs, among many other assignments. So two people who are extremely well positioned to talk about what we're going to be talking about today, namely the complex nature of the relationship between these two complex countries and where we are in that relationship now. They're going to be joined on stage between two Brookings scholars who will moderate the discussion and engage in the discussion and lead our work on Mexico here, Dr. Maria Solis and Dr. Vanda Felbab Brown. Over the last two decades, it seems to me, the United States and Mexico have become not only more deeply integrated economically, but have also cooperated on managing a complex border agenda and an agenda which transcends that border. But the last couple of years have thrown a lot of those issues into doubt in terms of how they'll be managed, what the perception of the relationship on either side of the border is, and where we go from here. The renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement into the what's now known as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, UMCA, or something along those lines, clearly challenged both Mexico City and Washington in terms of the management of the relationship, and I think it was a huge relief to all concerned when those two parties plus Canada reached an agreement. But there were clearly costs to the relationship through that process, and one of the questions for today is where are we and where do we go, building on the conclusion of the trilateral trade agreement. Tensions along the border continue to rise, with the continued discussion of the border wall and caravans and migrants and the deployment of U.S. troops to the border, et cetera. I think we have seen the U.S.-Mexico relationship bend, not break, but how far it's bent and how do we bend it to the right shape continues to be a question in front of us. This is not or should not be a zero-sum relationship. It seems to me that both countries have a lot to gain by deepening their understanding of one another, by reopening channels of trade, and working together on issues of migration, security, drug trafficking, poverty, inequality, both of which are challenges to both of our countries. The recently elected president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, begins his six-year term in office 10 days from today. Brookings scholars have been writing, talking about how he should approach some of the tough challenges in front of him. There'll be lots of debate around his tenure. We here will be very focused on the changing nature of Mexican politics and policy, the relationship between the two countries, and how we build on it and what it means for U.S.-Mexico relations. With that, I'm going to turn the floor over to our moderators, Maria Solis and Vanda Felbab Brown, but please join me in welcoming the two distinguished guests to Brookings today.
Is it good now? Yeah. Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to welcome you to our conversation today, a deep dive on U.S.-Mexico relations, where we are today, where we're going next. And we're going to start first by framing remarks from Ambassador Gutierrez and Ambassador Wayne, and then I'll moderate a discussion on trade issues, and my colleague Wanda will moderate a conversation on border security, immigration. So Ambassador Gutierrez, if you would like to offer some opening remarks, please.
Thank you very much, Mireya. Good morning to all of you. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the Brookings Institute for hosting this important event. I think it comes at a very opportune time. I'll be very brief on my initial remarks to give as much possible time to the questions and answer and comments, and it's a pleasure to share this panel with all the guests that are here. When I was being confirmed almost 2 years ago as ambassador of Mexico to the United States by the Mexican Senate, I said that the U.S.-Mexico relationship was at a critical moment, one in which we could either achieve a much more mature relationship or one in which we could have a major setback. I think that what the 2 years that have transpired are important because we achieved to get, you know, to a much better place than the one we were with respect to trade. There is now a successful conclusion of the negotiations, and I think with a reasonable horizon to have a new trade agreement between the three countries. I think that was important. The other part I think that we're missing, to be absolutely honest, is that we need to find, I think, still a different way to manage the immigration phenomenon between Mexico, the United States, and the Central American countries. And I think that's still, by and large, pending. A lot has been done during the past 2 years. And until that happens, I think that we continue to be at a very, you know, critical moment. We're in a better shape, I think, in the overall bilateral relationship than the one we were 2 years ago for a series of reasons that I'll be happy to discuss. But I think we're not quite yet there in terms of achieving a new favorable status quo for the two countries.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Gutierrez. Ambassador Wayne.
Well, let me just step back for a minute and say that the U.S.-Mexico relationship is probably the most underappreciated relationship that the United States has, in that it touches the daily lives of more U.S. citizens than any other relationship. And this is a combination of our history, of the fact we have 35 million Mexican-American citizens. We trade $1 million a minute. We have all sorts of human interactions, a lot of it good, but also some challenges, including migration, including fighting crime that crosses the border in both directions. And this makes it really important that we invest in doing all that we can to manage the challenges well and to take advantage of the opportunities. As Ambassador Gutierrez said, it is a big step forward that we've reached agreement on a successor to NAFTA. NAFTA supports 5 million U.S. jobs. It supports several million jobs in Mexico, too. So there's a lot of good that comes out of this relationship. And then if we add Canada in, it becomes even more important. But if we look at what's happened during the 25 years or so since NAFTA came into effect, what we've seen is a gradual building of cooperative relationships across wider and wider swaths of policy issues between the two countries. And we've seen a production network that's been built by the private sector, not by the governments, by the private sector of the two countries. And this isn't just manufacturing, it's farmers. All sorts of farmers depend on selling things back and forth between the two countries and between the three countries if we think of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. So let me just end on this note that this is a really important relationship. We do need to invest in it. I agree fully that migration is an area that we have to work on and get to a consensus, and fighting crime and public security is another very serious area to work on, an area where there are not easy solutions, but it is well worth the investment to get to a common agenda.
Thank you very much for those opening remarks. And let's move the discussion now to the trade negotiation that both of you referenced. I think it's fair to say that when the renegotiation of the North America Free Trade Agreement started, the prospects were not very good. You had the American president saying that NAFTA was the worst trade agreement ever, and also threatening the possible withdrawal of the United States from the trade agreement. And it's true that both the three teams of negotiators could see eye to eye on the modernization agenda. We know that NAFTA was negotiated almost 25 years ago, and it was important to bring that trade agreement to the digital era, for example. But you could also notice that the United States brought to the table proposals that were tough and that were also considered red lines by the Mexicans and the Canadians. For example, a sunset clause that would allow the trade agreement to expire or terminate 5 years down the road if the three countries did not agree to renew it. Or the idea that cars produced in North America that would benefit from this preferential trade agreement would have to incorporate 50% of American content. Those were very tough proposals. Then also take into account the broader trade issues happening as you had the three countries negotiating intensely NAFTA. The fact that the United States decided to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum, and both Mexico and Canada retaliated. So tension, if you will, in the trade relationship. The dynamics were different as well. There was a moment when, in May, when it was clear that it was not possible to reach an agreement, there was a break, and when the negotiators came back to the table, it was mostly the United States and Mexico talking, reaching an agreement, and for a while there was a concern that Canada might not make it to the finish line. Eventually they did, and the trilateral agreement was preserved. So I highlight this because I want to emphasize how unusual this negotiation was, and the stakes could not be higher for all three countries involved. So, Ambassador Gutierrez, to you first, but also I would like to hear from Ambassador Wayne. How can we explain that the negotiations did not flounder? If you could be as candid as possible, when did you think that there were moments where it really looked like this might not work? When were you feeling down, if you will, in a negotiation? And what happened that the negotiations were able to continue forward?
Thank you very much, Mireya. First of all, let me start by saying that, you know, we're the deal that finally was nailed down by the executive branches is quite a different result from where we originally started discussions. As it, you know, it's only natural on any trade agreement. I think that I am convinced that the trade agreement is good for Mexico, it's good for the United States, it's good for Canada, and it's good for the region as a whole. It's not perfect, but it works. And given the circumstances, that needs to be taken into account. What are the things that I would point to that I think allow us to, you know, to get to where we are? Number one is, you know, when we came in 2 years ago and we started to listen to people, experts, you know, ex-foreign minister, trade ministers, about how to handle this one, the recommendations were completely different. And that was, I think, you know, reflected the fact that nobody knew exactly how to deal with this. And that's from where we started. But four things were important. One was establishing trust, irrespective of the viewpoints of each of the parties. We clearly did not see eyeball to eyeball on many things on the trade agenda with the Trump administration, but we needed to establish trust. It's difficult to get to an agreement when you don't trust the guy sitting on the other side of the table, irrespective of what you think of his or her positions. And that, I think, we were able to establish it. And that was very important. The second thing is we managed, I think, to engage a broader coalition. This is not only about the governments, as Ambassador Wayne was rightly pointing out. We managed to engage the private sectors, academia, governors, mayors, legislatures from both sides, and from Canada always, to be part of the discussion. The important thing is that when we did that, I think our narrative was the same with them as with the administration, in order not to lose that level of trust. But getting a broader coalition of stakeholders activated with respect to the agreement was important. The third thing, I think, is just a matter of it's a learning curve. And everybody goes through a learning curve. Any administration that starts anywhere in the world goes through a learning curve. And I think that even if you look at how the trade agreement was analyzed, NAFTA was built by the administration in their terms. I'm not necessarily saying that we agree with that. But it became evident that Mexico and Canada were not the greatest challenge, that, you know, perhaps there were other, you know, challenges that were far important than us. And I think that and the other thing is, you know, it was important. There were several times, April of 2017. It's now, you know, a legendary date, April 19, because it was, we came very close of losing NAFTA, and there was a letter hanging around somewhere in the White House, perhaps to be signed. And there were a lot of people trying to, you know, opine on the matter and you know, get to the point that say, you know, this is important, let's give it a shot. You know, and several other, you know, we didn't finish in 2017. We extended it to March. So I think throughout these 2 years, there was always a significant level of, you know, concern and tension. But I think that the important part was, let's, you know, abstracting ourselves a bit for the narrative, sometimes a difficult public narrative about the issues, and steady as she goes. You know, we had a strategic objective, and we remain steady to reach that objective. And I think that in the end, we managed to do fairly well.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Gutierrez. Ambassador Wayne, you know, it seems clear that on at least two occasions, President Trump came very close to withdrawing the United States from a trade agreement, and yet that did not happen. What is your assessment of what kept the U.S. administration working towards amending some of its proposals, essentially finding compromise, even though they had started with these very tough positions to begin with?
I think it was very important that all of the stakeholders in this broader relationship were mobilized. There are, if you look at the broader NAFTA, 14 million U.S. jobs about $2.3 million of trade each minute across both borders. A lot of farmers, with Canada being the number one and Mexico being the number three trading partner for farmers, the selling client. All of that over time built up and became a more active force, reminding people in the administration how important this relationship was. So as there were ups and downs in the negotiations, for sure, there were always these voices saying, we can't let this fail. And it wasn't just the business community. It was the business community, the farming community, the Senate, the governors of the United States who kept weighing in with the White House and saying, this is really important. Let's get it right. I think it is also true that, as Ambassador Gutierrez said, it was clear that there was another country in Asia that people decided might be a bigger trade threat than our two neighbors and our two largest buyers in the world. And that helped also. And building that, the hard work and steady work of the negotiators on all sides who kept trying to keep focused on building that trust and then getting to a better solution on the issues was really important. There was that sort of steady working away that went on even though there was this turmoil taking place in decision making. But I think it all came out in a good place that preserves this tremendously important set of relationships that we have, both to sell things to each other, but also to build things together.
Thank you very much. And I'm glad that both of you make reference to the fact that the U.S.-Mexico relation is not just about the interaction between the two administrations, but that it's about how the economy is, how the society is closer together now over the past two decades. And I bring this because I would like to ask all of you, how do you think the renegotiation of the trade agreement affected the public perception in both Mexico and the United States about the merits or demerits of closer economic integration? Let me provide some context. The original NAFTA agreement has long been controversial. Critics can be found on both sides of the border. In the case of Mexico, fears about U.S. economic domination, the fact that the economic benefits have been very uneven, that you have a North that is integrated with the United States and a South that's left behind, those arguments have been made for a very long time. And in the United States, we know that there have always been concerns that there could be unfair competition because of Mexico's lower wages or lower environmental standards. So NAFTA has been criticized from the get-go. In some ways, it has become a punching bag. But what was interesting to me in the past year, year and a half, was that when NAFTA seemed almost about to disappear, when we were really worried that the agreement could not make it, that many different groups, communities, stakeholders began to articulate an argument for why we needed these trade agreements. So what's your point of view of how much has the trade negotiation impacted public opinion, but also the other side of this, how much has the public lost trust because there was tension in the negotiation, because it's still a challenging issue. So how do you think the public comes out from the NAFTA renegotiation? I'll go to Ambassador Wayne actually first, and then Ambassador Gutierrez.
Well, I think if you can look at the polls, mm-hmm. and you can see that there has been a significant upswing in positive views of the value of NAFTA for the United States. In 2008, it was clearly only about 42% of the population thought it was a value. In 2018, it was 62%. So that's a significant rise. And I think there are several parts of this, of course. Part of it is that there was a lot more discussion of NAFTA. So people came to understand that, gee, jobs depend on that. Gee, farm sales depend on that. We didn't know that. And I think that's in part true because we shied away from talking about NAFTA for most of this century. It was just, let's just let it go. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of the administration was it's working fine, it's good, but we know there is this longstanding opposition. But once there started to be a lot of debate and people started coming out, as you said, and explaining what was the value, I think that did change opinions. I think also in the United States, some people didn't like all the criticism of Mexico as it came out, to be very honest. And that isn't as much, it's not only, of course, about trade in this sense. It's about migration, it's about other issues. And I think that you can see the same thing in polls of views of Mexico in the United States. Mexico became more favorably viewed in the United States during this period of time. So I think it's that combination of factors, and I think we do come away in the United States with a more positive view. In Mexico, as Ambassador Gutierrez already mentioned, the polls show a significant drop in favorable views of the United States, down to about low 30s% positive view, favorable views of the United States, from up in the 60s in 2015. So there, though I don't know how lasting that will be, there certainly has been a negative effect, but I don't think it's all because of NAFTA. I think it's more about the general tenor of comments about Mexico during this period of time.
Yes, thank you very much.
Ambassador Gutierrez. I'll start by saying that the problem was that NAFTA was oversold and underexplained everywhere. Oversold because I think it was, you know, it was sold as that this is going to be the solution to every, you know, to a lot of the things that are going on that are bad in each country, and that's not the case. You know, free trade can do some things, but not all of them. And it was underexplained in the sense that we did not do, I guess, a good effort to explain what was NAFTA or what was, you know, the trade still is responsible and capable of. And I think that I'll give you an example. Free trade nowadays is often blamed because of loss in the manufacturing sector, not only in the United States, elsewhere. And I think there is significant evidence that'll point that the vast majority of those job losses are due to a result of technological change, not trade. Of course, trade involves that some sectors, firms are going to, you know, suffer and adjust, and that's what free trade is about. But the balance, it's certainly positive. So If people are not, if governments, to the extent that we are responsible, along with, I guess, academia, do not explain exactly what you know NAFTA is and this new trade agreement are responsible for and capable of, we will always have a problem. I think that at the same time, Mexico did not, to be perfectly clear, countries compete here in the United States for influence, space, and leadership within the United States, if I may use that word. And after NAFTA, I think we fell in our laurels, and we did not took a systematic effort. We did not engage in a systematic effort to talk about NAFTA, to talk about how much it has changed Mexico, why is it important for Mexico, why is it important for the United States, until quite recently. And they're a very good example. Now, whether public opinion now, how is public opinion in the United States? I tend to think that there is much more attention. People are much more aware about Mexico nowadays than they were 2 years ago here in general. Go talk to soybean growers in the Midwest or corn growers in Nebraska. Go talk to the people that are working in a manufacturing firm in Flint, Michigan, that it's owned by a Mexican firm. Or go talk, and they will, you know, they will tell you. The problem is that there is not a organized, you know, at such coalition that will talk about these benefits. It's much easier, you know, the opponents, to be clear. It's much more easier for them to organize. I think that Mexico has a good opportunity right now because the level of attention with respect to Mexico, I think, has risen in the United States. And that gives us a good opportunity to engage in, again, in a systematic and consistent effort to talk about these things and to understand, as Ambassador Wayne was saying, this is not a zero-sum game. And there are people hurting in America that have been displaced of their jobs, and we need to take that into account. The same has happened in Mexico. I will conclude with another example. You know, again, talking about trade and corn. No, Mexico is a great buyer of products from all over the Midwest: corn, soybeans, sorghum, a lot of products. Many of those people did not actually knew that they would sell to someone, a distributor, and that all of their products go to. Now they know, and it's important. And at the same time in Mexico, when there were people of concern and people talked about, NAFTA is going to destroy the agricultural sector in Mexico, which I happen to think that's not true, go and talk to tomato growers or to avocado growers. And we now export, I think, several billions of dollars in avocados, and it's quite successful. Because we're more competitive in growing, producing, and selling avocados, tomatoes, and eggplant than we are grains, period. And both sides are winning because of that. And there's a huge agricultural trade that's beneficial. That story, at the same time, I think the other thing we need to do is talk a little bit more about the stories that are closer to the people. Because if you talk in very abstract terms, and I used to go often and go out and say, U.S.-Mexico trade, $1.5 billion every day, and we're sort of the traditional bullet points, and that's all true and that's good. But we need a narrative that relates to the stories and to the local living of how people are living locally. And I think that that's the challenge as we move forward.
Thank you. And I want to move forward and talk about prospects for the ultimate fate of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement in the sense that, a very important milestone is coming up at the end of this month when the three countries will gather and sign the new trade agreement, but that still needs to be ratified. And, I shudder a little bit when I say that because we know how difficult that is here in the United States. So a general question, I'll start with Ambassador Wayne, as to whether you are optimistic or pessimistic on the chances of the new Congress that's going to be seated next year, where there's going to be a Democratic majority in the House, that they will vote positively for NAFTA. I'll add that USTR Lighthizer incorporated some provisions in NAFTA that should please Democratic lawmakers on, wage provisions and things of that nature. But it's not clear that the unions have rallied behind. It's not clear that Democrats coming to the House are going to go that route. So, as they say, don't count your chickens until they exactly. So, what are the chances then that we'll have a ratification of NAFTA? What are the chances that we'll have some kind of renegotiation through side letters or through reopening the agreement proper? Some things that we're all familiar with, painfully. So, Ambassador Wayne and Ambassador Gutierrez.
Well, I think we need to protect the eggs and encourage them to be hatched. First, let me mention, there is still one big issue to be sorted through, which are the tariffs on steel and aluminum, yes, and then the counter tariffs from Canada and Mexico, which are severely harming American agricultural exports. Mm-hmm. So I hope that can be worked through in the weeks ahead. I think we will see objections from in the new Congress, especially from the House of Representatives, from with a labor concern. And I think it'll be very important also what the International Trade Commission comes up with in its findings. They had a hearing, a number of hearings the other day, for example, with the auto companies asking about all of the impacts of the new provisions in there. So I think what they come up with will fuel a lot of debate. But it's also important to remember that this is not just going to be a vote on the merits of what's in the treaty. Mm-hmm. It will be some political calculations, especially in the House of Representatives, about how the Democrats want to treat this. I think the driving force toward approving something is, in fact, the same force that drove the three countries to agreement, which is a lot of jobs are riding on this, the prosperity of a lot of companies, of a lot of farmers, our competitiveness in the world is very much affected by having certainty of a well-working, well-oiled relationship between the three countries. And even if we get this trade agreement in place, there's then a whole agenda to implement it, to address other parts of the efficiency of this relationship, to reduce costs that will help make companies in all three countries more competitive against our other traders around the world. And that is really important. So I think that's going to be the main force driving toward an agreement. But I'll honestly say it's going to be a really hard slog, and I don't know where it will come out in the end.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Ambassador
Gutierrez. I think that the agreement has a fair to good chance of going being ratified by, you know, the three legislative bodies, more towards good. I think, you know, it's never certain, and it's never easy to pass a trade agreement as comprehensive as this one in any legislature. It's never a walk in the park. But I think, again, it has a good chance of passing. Talking about, you know, trust, you know, we have to give, I would give credit to the fact that when it became evident that, you know, the three sides were really trying to get a deal in respect of differences, it was obvious that we needed to think about what would make the deal feasible. I give credit to Ambassador Lighthizer, because he always had very clear in his mind that we needed to construct an agreement that not only would be feasible to be signed by the executives, but actually that it would make it, likely to go through the Congresses. And I think that we managed to achieve that. It's obvious that there is a concern here on the Democrat side about labor. I think that if you look at the specific annex on labor that is part of the agreement, it will be easy to see that it's a huge step forward in terms of improving labor standards and union transparency and union independence in Mexico. I think that it's just a matter of really reviewing it. I think that it's there. At the same time, I think we managed to, get to address some of the concerns that were more important for the Republican side of the aisle, such as ISDS in an intelligent investor state dispute settlement, or the so-called sunset, which we now like to call sunrise clause, now sunset. And I think so. The equilibrium, I think it makes it feasible. And the fact that there has been relatively radio silence about it, I think it's good. Sometimes silence is better than a public discussion, or not public discussion, but, you know, positions. I think that the unions here have been, you know, careful. From what I've seen, most legislatures that are deeply involved here are have talked about, you know, we need to look in detail, but, you know, we welcome the fact that there's a concluded negotiation. So I think it has a fair chance. On the Mexican side, I think it's very important to emphasize that we had, under our very difficult political settings, we had the president-elect team be part of the, you know, discussions with Ambassador Seade. You know, if one would look at the nastiness of the Mexican campaign, would have never imagined that we were going to be side by side with the, you know, the present government and the government-elect trying to get this done. I think that attests to the fact that there is, on the part of the government of Mexico, a very clear understanding that this is important. And the guy just happened to have a majority in both houses. So I think there's a good chance that that will go through the Mexican Senate. I'm not so well abreast on Canada, but I think it's pretty much the same thing. Let me conclude by saying something that I have mentioned before in Congress and to my interlocutors here. I often said, listen, the world nowadays is a complex situation. You see a lot of difficulties in the Middle East. You see a lot of strain in the traditional NATO alliance. Europe under a lot of, you know, reflecting about, you know, its integration process. You do see a resurgence in China. You also see tension in Asia. Why complicate North America? No, we're doing okay. We have our challenges, but this is important, and North America is, in a sense, is very much in a good place. And I think this just goes to the point of Ambassador Wayne that it won't be only about the trade agreement itself. If you put it in a broader context, I think that's the way it should be analyzed. It makes a lot of sense to get this out of the way as soon as possible.
Thank you. My last question to Ambassador Gutierrez, building on these broader trends, Mexico's economic future. And what I want to ask in particular is that when Mexico decided to change its economic model, decided to open its economy and integrate into international markets, there was a very important core assumption behind this decision, and that is that the United States would continue to play a role as champion of a rules-based trading system, as an advocate for multilateralism. I would pose that that assumption may no longer hold. We don't know. It's a period of uncertainty. What we know is that the United States has decided to impose tariffs using national security considerations on allies, on neighbors, that the United States, the current administration, is skeptical of the World Trade Organization, and that there's an escalating tariff war with China that can become more than that, a deeper economic tension. So my question to you is, how does Mexico, a country that decided to become a trading nation, navigate the geopolitics of trade? On the one hand, you could say this creates some opportunities. The U.S.-China tension could produce a restructuring of supply chains. Some of these companies may decide to operate in Mexico. But on the other hand, if there is protectionism, if there is a weakening of the World Trade Organization, that hurts everyone, and certainly countries that depend on international trade as much as Mexico does. People have talked in the past in Mexico about diversification. The fact is that 80% of Mexican exports still come to the United States. So what can Mexico do?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, for Mexico, believing in a rule-based system, specifically with respect to trade and investment, does not only relate to the United States, but to every country. It's true that we have a very concentrated economic relation with the United States, but we're a very open economy, over 40 trade agreements with all over the world, because we believe that that's the best way to remain a competitive and attractive destiny for investment and trade, and we will continue to do that irrespective of what the United States does or not. Yes, there is concern. I think that discussion on multilateralism versus bilateralism, or even something a little bit more harsh, has always been there, and we're experiencing, I think, I think there's some sort of, you know, pendular dynamics to this. I think we're overall in the world experiencing and finalize, you know, assimilating some of the changes, very profound changes that took place at the end of the last century and the beginning of this one with respect to globalization and trade, and we're adjusting to those. And I remain positive that we will find a way to continue with that, you know, idea, overall idea about openness. And Mexico, you know, again, I think that has learned over the years that those rule-based systems are important, especially for a developing country. And it's not always easy. And I think that here in the United States, the debate also will take place. So, in the end, there's two sides of that story and that debate. And I couldn't say much more about how it's going to look in the future. But I do believe that that's the right way to go. And it is especially in this type of context and circumstances where it's really important to remain steadfast with respect to what a rules-based system means for the world. With respect to, China, I would say, I think that there's, in the year 2000, everybody decided to bring China into the World Trade Organization. I think that was the right step. But I think that there's also, growing opinions that China must play better by the rules that the WTO imply. There is concern about intellectual property. There is concern about other trade practices. And those things need to be discussed openly. Mexico in itself has, we have a trade relationship with China of about $70 billion. We export $5 billion and export around 65, and import around 65. Yes, there's opportunity. And we are open to trade. And we're open. I think that there was recently a press release with respect to that by Mexico's foreign minister. We're open. We value the relationship with China. But in the end, we need to make sure that our own interests are served.
Thank you so much. So, Banda, over to you.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I will take the conversation to the many other dimensions, security, border, immigration. But I actually do want to ask one question about the future and the new deal, and perhaps directed to you, Ambassador Wayne. So a core understanding of the signing of NAFTA and the regular negotiations is that the deals are to last, that they are to enable investment and decisions that don't change every 2-3 years, every 5 years. And yet a very important element of the renegotiation was to remove that, to put in clauses that the renegotiation would have to take place repeatedly, to eliminate that certainty for political consideration, and with the claim that this would then allow to take care of those who don't benefit from the deal, whether in the United States or Mexico. Ambassador Gutierrez talked about the importance of explaining the benefits. Now, if you now look at the new deal, assuming that it's passed by all three legislations and that it really becomes a new deal, is it going to last? Is it going to be a deal for 10 years, 20 years? Or are the political pressures, the circumstances in the United States or perhaps elsewhere going to bring about another really wrenching debate about what the relationship, economic and broader relationship, should look like? How confident should we be that there is a happy ending?
Well, that's a difficult question. But let me say, what I will say is I think it's actually going to be good to have more regular reviews mm-hmm. of this new agreement. We did not do that under NAFTA. There was supposed to be a regular review process in NAFTA, but it was never really serious. I went to some of them, and it was more just a rote talking about the differences and where there were differences, and they really didn't get fixed. So having a process that allows people to bring up things that aren't working or they're not happy with in a serious way, I think is good. And it can involve people more. As we were all saying, one of the challenges during the NAFTA period was that there wasn't discussion about the good things that were happening in NAFTA, just the bad things. So I think one of the things that's incumbent on everybody is when they do get together for a review to talk about what's working also mm-hmm. and the benefits that are coming from that. That can also address one of the other problems we had with NAFTA, which Ambassador Gutierrez mentioned, is that NAFTA got blamed for problems that weren't caused by NAFTA. Most of the serious studies looking at the job losses either look to technology or they look to China. if you
automation.
It's sort of a rounding error, the number of jobs that were lost overall to NAFTA. Now, that wasn't a rounding error to the individuals who lost jobs, but the problem was there weren't public policies that actually helped take care of those individuals and give them some viable options for new employment or new opportunities. And that also, I think, can be healthy if we have this discussion after 6 years and then maybe six more years looking at it. So it I think it can be, we can make it into a positive as we go forward. And so I think one of the lessons that I would draw from this period of debate is how many people really do get benefit from the relation with our two neighbors. And as Ambassador Gutierrez was saying, that brings an important stability to the United States. I mean, how blessed we are to have two neighbors we can work closely with compared to many parts of the world.
You very importantly highlight that NAFTA has been blamed for a lot of issues it didn't cause, particularly automation. And of course, the challenge of automation and its impacts on job losses is only going to grow, not just in the United States and in Mexico, elsewhere. And the vital importance then of understanding that its policies completely separate from the trade deal that need to address those. Yet the White House certainly pitched the renegotiation as the solution to problems that it incorrectly linked to NAFTA, and it now presents the New Deal as a solution to problems that have nothing to do with NAFTA. And so having that economic awareness seems to me fundamental for keeping the trade relationship positive and going on.
For example, if I just might add, I think the three governments and societies and private sectors need to start talking about workforce development, for example. Mm-hmm. They have not really done that. And that relates to the new technology coming in, the training that's necessary. Each nation may have its own responses to that, but we should be learning from each other. And there are good practices available in all three countries, and we're all going to face this wave of technology and the demand for higher and new skills on a regular basis. So as neighbors, we should be build that into this future agenda.
Ambassador Gutierrez, Mireya talked about the precarious nature of the renegotiations, of the many moments when at least some of us were holding our breath. Is this the end? Stunning announcement from the White House that withdrawal was imminent, unilateral withdrawal, and then stepping back from the brink. The other aspect of the renegotiations, of course, was enormously strong, one might even say hostile rhetoric from the White House about Mexico during the campaign, but throughout the relationship, starting with the wall talk about the crime that's pouring from Mexico into the United States. And even just very recently, the president has spoken about invasion from Mexico, referring to the migrants from Central America that are trying to claim asylum. Can you please talk to us about that context of the security rhetoric, of building up an image that there is an imminent, enormous security threat from the southern border, and how that was affecting the negotiations, what that meant for the negotiating teams, but also what it meant, of course, for the politics in Mexico.
Sure. Well, when NAFTA was being negotiated, negotiators tried as hard as possible to keep all the other stuff, security, immigration, away from the trade table. And they managed to do that pretty well. And that was, in that context, I think it made all the sense in the world. This time around, it was a completely different context, a completely different administration, in a completely different political context. And the narrative was sometimes, difficult, because we were not in the midst of a trade negotiation. We were not dealing only with that, but also with, border security, immigration, and sometimes and to be clear, irrespective of what anybody thinks, when the president of the United States says something, it's important. So it does generate an influence in what is going on. I think that we, but at the same time, in this time around, President Peña Nieto said, as we go into the trade negotiation, we need to look at the relationship comprehensively, because there's a lot of value for the United States in respect of the differences that we do have, the security and immigration cooperation that has with Mexico. So in a sense, that was also implicit as part of the negotiation. Many times we had to, we've always tried to keep a policy of no surprises with the United States, trying to be, and it was very clear that what I think was helpful was that we established clear limits. We were not focusing so much on the narrative, but again, in a strategic result, and we tried to make very clear what our limits were, and we were, willing to stand off the table if those limits were broken. And it's difficult, but I think that was what managed to take us here. So,
Ambassador Wayne, so there was the rhetoric, but at the same time, and often very significant threats made from the White House. At the same time, security cooperation has gone on. It has not certainly collapsed. Whether security cooperation on the southern Mexican border, with Mexico not deciding to use that as a lever, perhaps sometimes linking the relationship of the southern border and Mexico's efforts to stem migration there to the renegotiation, but never actually employing that lever, and other cooperation has gone on. Where do you see the U.S.-Mexico security cooperation right now, as we will have a new administration coming in Mexico?
Well, I think it's important to put this in a little bit of historic context. Since the Merida Initiative, which was a U.S.-Mexico initiative looking at public security broadly, came into effect in 2007-2008, cooperation between the public security forces of both countries has grown immensely. And it's important to remember that part of this was fighting organized crime, part of it was modernizing the border, part of it was helping Mexico strengthen its capacities of its institution, and part of it was helping communities that were being overwhelmed by local violence from crime. And so through all that cooperation and the law enforcement cooperation that went along with some of the assistance, people got to build trust with each other, just like in the trade area. They found new ways to work together rather than just pointing at each other and blaming the other side. They said, okay, we got a problem. We each have a responsibility to solve it. How can we do that? And there was a lot of progress made. So, interestingly, in the first year of this new administration in the cross-border crime area, there was a lot of continued process. There was an agreement on a strategy that went all the way from looking at where the drugs come from, if they're grown, where they're grown, how they get transported, how they get across the border, how what happens to them once they're in the United States, what happens to the money that's received, can we track the money? And so conceptually, there was actually an even further step forward between the new governments. But it is true that then the critical rhetoric did get in the way of that cooperation. And the Senate of Mexico twice, I think, told the government to hold off or stop cooperating with the United States because of remarks that were made, which made it harder. It didn't stop all cooperation, but it made it harder to do. So we're at a point right now with a new government coming into Mexico where they've just announced a new approach, a more comprehensive approach to public security. And the U.S. and Mexico are going to have to review where they've worked together, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and hopefully they will come up with an agreed agenda for going forward in the new political context in Mexico. It's very, very important that this takes place. Just a couple of examples. It's estimated that the illegal drug sales in the United States make $20 to $30 billion a year in profits for the smuggling organizations, where a lot of that money heads back toward Mexico, and it doesn't do good things when it gets back to Mexico. How can we do that? The United States has this terrible opioid addiction problem that needs to be tackled. It has to be tackled in the United States through new, better programs for treating addicts, for preventing addiction, but also better law enforcement in that whole chain. We need to cooperate with the Mexicans well in taking care of that. Mexico has very serious public security problems that have led to a significant rise in violent homicides in that country. All of it is not related to drug smuggling to the United States, but some of it is related to those organized groups that do that. So there's an interest, very much an interest from the Mexican side to continuing to work with the United States on a number of these areas. So it's a really important area with hard work to do, and we now have this window where we should take a fresh look at this and see how we can go forward together.
Certainly, President Trump has often claimed incorrectly that the United States is experiencing a significant rise in violent crime and often trying to link it to Mexico and drug trafficking. Those claims are not supported by any kind of evidence. Nonetheless, Mexico is going through an excruciatingly violent period with death rates that are on par or surpass many a country in civil war. Those are not new statistics. They've been around since the inception of Merida and prior to Merida. When President Peña Nieto came to the office, he made public security a core element of his administration focus, setting out to reduce violent homicides by 50% in his first 6 months. When he concludes his term, Mexico will have experienced the most violent year in 2017 with perhaps as many as 30 or even more than 30,000 homicides, and this year probably will top that number. Ambassador Gutierrez, what are the core challenges? What, in your view, despite the efforts of the Mexican administration, President Peña Nieto, President Calderón, Merida, beyond Merida, what have been the core obstacles that have made the efforts not delivering on that core element of what the administration needs to do?
Well, I think that there's obviously a big debate about what has happened. Anybody that has worked in the present administration and the past administrations in Mexico can certainly not be satisfied with the results. I tend to think that what is going on is my experiences as a result of different factors, not only one. It's not a simple explanation to what has happened. But let me try to describe it, in my opinion, in the following way. A security strategy is about five things: police, prosecutors, judges, jails, and the social fabric. And you need to work on those five elements to actually have a successful security strategy. I think that there has been relative success on the social fabric, and I think that the in the following sense, I think that there was, I'll point to some examples. Juarez and Tijuana, there seems to be cases where the work done to recover social fabric was important in achieving a better outcome. I think that the president-elect and his government have it right in stressing the importance of continue to build up, improve the social fabric. If young people are, if organized crime is able to hire young people at a faster rate than they are put behind bars, it's difficult to have an end to this. And I think that's important. If you look at some of the metrics on economic development during the Peña Nieto administration, I think they're far from perfect, but they're successful in terms of employment. There, a lot more needs to be done. But I think the stability, the job employment creation, and other social indicators would point to the fact that there was a serious effort in that regard. We have, I think, a big problem. I'll jump to the prosecutors. I think we're in the midst of a transition of our judicial system. Well, first, of our own creating a new general attorney's office in Mexico. And I think that it's difficult. We are not in good shape there because of two factors. One is a lot of turnout in the leadership of the important Attorney General office, and also because lack of resources, and we are in the midst of creating a new Attorney General's office, and that delay has not been good, because on the prosecutor's parts, where it's crucial, and that leads, you know, it's important to impunity. On the judges, we are in the midst of the biggest 100-year transformation, moving from a complete, you know, to a completely different judicial system, and that has been difficult. I think that there are some encouraging results that were pointed out by the project on International Project on Justice recently, that they point to the fact that that system seems to be working despite the difficulties. We have jails. We need to work more in jails. We have had serious problems with jails, and that's, until that is addressed fully and thoroughly, we will continue to have problems. And then I'll point to the police. And my opinion there is that Mexico does not have sufficiently and appropriately trained police forces per 100,000 inhabitants as compared to any other place in the world. And if you do not have enough police forces, certainly at federal, state, or local level, you're going to have a problem. And I think that building up that police force and having Mexico's army be part of that effort, because precisely of a lack of capacity at that level, is not something that anybody, you know, feels thrilled about it. Not this administration, not the next administration, not the past administration, but there's a clear recognition that until we build up that police capacity, we're going to have the armed forces doing internal security manners. Everybody, I think, agrees that we need to get out of that as soon as possible, because there are other challenges with that. But I don't think, have enough police capacity. And if we do, and that's probably the number one factor. And until that things happen, there's a very strong debate nowadays in Mexico about the new policy that's got been put forward, and I think it deserves, obviously, the benefit of the doubt, and I'm sure there will be a lot more discussion on what the government-elect has presented.
Ambassador Wayne, you were ambassador in Mexico during part of the Peña Nieto administration, and you saw how it was trying to reshape the security policy, what it learned, what it adopted from the previous Calderón administration. And you also, of course, were intimately witnessing, involved in seeing the issues of police reform that had been right at the core of what President Calderón wanted, that had really goes back many more decades, that many prior administrations in the 1990s embraced and achieved, sought to achieve, I should rather say. And yet we are still in the situation where Ambassador Gutierrez says that's the core difficulty. An enormous amount of the U.S. Merida and beyond Merida assistance has been focused on police reform. Why are we still in this really difficult situation? Why so little has been successfully achieved out of that?
Well, there are a number of factors that go into this. I think one is that there really wasn't a coherent, comprehensive strategy. There were very good strategies in certain parts of this mm-hmm. effort. But you weren't really going after the problem consistently from all angles. For example, some of the first very good social programs working in disturbed communities were actually lost funding after several years, lost direction when they tried to spread from Monterrey and from Ciudad Juarez and from Tijuana to other cities. The professionalization program worked very good for certain people who got the training, but if those people didn't stay in that service, didn't remain prosecutors, for example, then you lost all that training. And a lot of them did leave that profession after a while because you hadn't created a profession that promised a lifelong future for a number of these people. So I think that I would say in that sense, the new ideas put forward are very interesting because they are trying to take a comprehensive problem where if you look at, here's this very unstable, uncontrolled element in parts in our society. Let's attack it from these eight different angles. Now, we'll have to see where the political debate comes out. And then, are you going to invest enough money to make this worthwhile? And will you keep attention on it? Which I think was also some of the problems in the last several years. Because if you look at the track of violent homicides, they actually reached a peak at the end of the Calderon administration. They then started going down. They went down to about 2014, and then they just started coming up. And they've continued, as you say, through this year. And it was as if there was a loss of focus. I don't know why that happened. The problem spread to other parts of the country. It went into other kinds of crime, not just drug smuggling, but oil smuggling, oil theft, and other things. And the authorities were just overwhelmed by this. So I'm hopeful that with this rethinking and the debate that's now going on about a more comprehensive policy, that Mexico will come out of it with a better sense of how to tackle this and will invest in bringing about those changes.
You alluded several times to the new plan, the 8-point plan that President-elect López Obrador just announced this past week. Perhaps for our audience, can you highlight the key elements and then have your reflection of how is this new, how it is different from when you were the U.S. ambassador? What are the new different elements, your take on that, as well as broader explanation of what are the core issues of the plan?
Well, there are eight principles to this. Now that you've tested me here, am I going to remember the eight principles or can I bend down to my folder and pull them out? But I think it ranges from creating jobs for young people, offering them educational opportunities, helping to revive civic morals in society through penal reform, through strengthening the justice system, strengthening the prisons, to creating a National Guard at the other side, which will be a new armed service that will draw from military police, the federal police, and will be deployed eventually in all parts of the country. They've divided the country up into 66 sections,
or regions, right?
And they will analyze each of those sections and then deploy forces there with the idea if they're more dangerous, they'll get faster deployments. But, of course, what remains is to train all of these people in the police skills. It's one thing to be a military police person, as you know, another to be a civilian police person. And then they still have to hook up with the prosecutors, the forensic experts, the people that collect evidence where there are gaps right now to make that work and then bring people into the justice system. One of the tremendous flaws is what's called impunity in Mexico, where even if you get arrested, you don't get convicted. And so one of the big things is start convicting guilty people. Now, at the same time, in this new policy is the idea of transitional justice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Where you can have a forgiveness and apology process, as has been done in other countries, reintegrate people who've been out of formal society, working in illegal activities in this case, bring them back in, help victims feel a sense of justice. At the same time, you're reintegrating people into society. That's a very big prospect and won't be easy to implement. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be explored, but it's going to be very deeply debated, and we'll see where that goes. And then there's drug legalization also, possibly legalizing marijuana. Some people have suggested finding a way to legalize some of the production of opium. Mm-hmm. We'll see where that goes. So it's to be applauded for its comprehensive nature, but it's going to take a lot of effort to reach agreement and then a lot of investment and hard work to bring it about. I hope it bears fruit.
Ambassador Gutierrez, in this plan that Ambassador Wayne just perfectly outlined, not missing an element and getting an A+ on this test that I just pulled off, where do you see will be any difficulties in U.S. bilateral cooperation? Are there any elements to it that the U.S. might take a pause at or not like?
The past 15 years and the past two especially, I think that the U.S. and Mexico, especially agencies on both sides, have learned two or three things. One is that it's really practically impossible to address transnational organized crimes unless you're working side by side with your neighbors and partners all over the world, especially if you're next to them. It just doesn't work. I think people now clearly understand that. The second thing that we've learned is that we simply lose time and energy pointing fingers. If we blame the United States because of the demand of drugs and they blame Mexico for the supply of drugs, we miss the bigger picture that there's a market and there are transnational crime organizations that move very quickly, are very agile, they move across borders, and they don't wait for bureaucracies to put themselves together. So we lose, they gain a strategic advantage if we don't work. And thirdly, that there needs to be trust. And that trust is a key element of security cooperation. I think those things are well grounded in the U.S.-Mexico bilateral relationship, irrespective of administrations. I like to think that the cooperation will continue, albeit changes, and there's always room for improvement. I think that the government-elect of Mexico has thankfully had a series of meetings with U.S. authorities over the last 2 to 3 months that are helpful and that would allow both sides to get up going very quickly as the new administration takes office. And I'm happy and I celebrate that. I think it's important that has happened. I think there are also going to be areas of challenge. I think dealing with decriminalization of whether it's marijuana or eventually talking about regularizing poppy cultivation in Mexico, are going to require a lot more explanation in terms of the benefits or not. I think that's an area to put attention into it. And I think that that will be the area that requires more attention. The other one, just very concluding, the support that Mexico gets from the United States through the Merit Initiative is important. I am a believer that it has helped cement the trust among security agencies. Not only it also implies a commitment on the part of the U.S. to recognize that there's shared responsibility by putting resources. I think those resources are important. I think that we perhaps need to do, we should have done a better job, meaning ourselves, in explaining more clearly, more openly and transparently what those resources are about and why are they important, so the next government is less skeptical about them. But I think, and I do hope, that that support will continue, because I think it's critical to the cooperation.
Well, there are many more issues yet, including, of course, cooperation on migration, the border, the wall that might not be funded. And about which we have written at Brookings extensively. But I'm mindful of the fact that we have 10 minutes and would like to allow at least some questions from the audience. So perhaps we can collect 3 questions and see whether we'll have time for any more. Please introduce yourself and be brief in your questions. The lady here in the front row, the gentleman on the side, and the gentleman across.
Merrily, International Trade Today. This is a question for Ambassador Gutierrez. Can you give us any insight on the timing of when the Senate might take up the implementing legislation on the labor changes that were part of the Constitution? And also any insight on where we are with lifting the retaliatory tariffs on 232 and getting a resolution there? We keep hearing that could happen before the signing.
Thank you. This has been very informative. My name is Douglas Carr. I'm a retired lawyer. I have family that lives in Mexico City. I have not heard any reference to one of the serious ongoing problems that Mexico has at the federal level of getting the private sector professional class to pay their income taxes. Is that a serious problem? problem, as it appears to be, to someone sitting here in the audience who doesn't live in Mexico? And is it part of the ongoing problem of funding?
Thank you. And the gentleman across.
Thank you. My name is Daryl Thompson. I'm with a strategic consulting firm here in D.C. called The Group. Mr. Ambassador, you hosted us at the Meridian Dinner and recently just was at a Meridian study group in Mexico City last week. Mr. Ambassador, you spoke of rising poll numbers, 62%. Mr. Ambassador, you spoke of personal narratives to change those poll numbers. What is the long-term outlook and effort from both countries to improve relations at the root level between the United States and Mexico and the outlook as both economies are integrated, cultures are integrated? How do you escalate that so that you can overcome rhetoric such as we've heard in the last few months?
Okay. That's it.
I'll start with the trade questions. On the steel tariffs, I'll repeat what I said yesterday, which is the expectation is that we will have, by the time of the signing, a solution to the tariffs on steel and aluminum, or at least a very clear track that gives certainty to all parties involved that a solution is coming. That implies we need to work on that heavily in the next 9 days, and I think that's precisely what we're doing. On the labor front, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, the annex that I referred to earlier talks about it is the expectation of the parties that the reform, the secondary reform on labor would be approved by the relevant legislative bodies in Mexico by January the 31st, if I'm not mistaken. It's important that that happens. And it also refers to the fact that without that that reform, the agreement might not be implemented. So that's crucial. And if I may add additionally, Leader Pelosi has expressed concern or, the importance that that reform should take place. That's the timing. I think that the new majority in the Mexican Congress sees very favorably that reform. Obviously, I cannot guarantee that that will happen immediately, but I think that there's a very fair chance because the things that are included in that agreement with respect to labor are, if not identical, pretty similar to the sorts of things that had been advocating by what is now the Morena parliamentary group. So I think that, again, there's a fair chance. That would be with respect to trade. On the income, Mexico has still a relatively low tax to GDP ratio as compared when we compare to ourselves to several Latin American countries and certainly OECD countries. I think there's several reasons for that. One of them was a low tax base, and if I'm not mistaken, the reform was undertaken by the Peña Nieto administration early in his administration, I think 2000 and the second year. It did raise significantly the income tax, and it also broadened the base. I can't remember the exact numbers, but the number of persons paying income tax has increased significantly. And there was also an effort to close loopholes. And yes, it is important to have a reasonable tax base because if not, it's difficult to have addressed some of the challenges that we have. That's obvious in taxes. There's always a debate about what's the best way to tax people, and nobody like taxes. But I think that if you look at the figures, and I cannot bring them to my mind right now, but the percentage of taxes to GDP, our tax base has increased during the past years, I think addressing part of your concern. And I'll leave the last one for Ambassador Wayne.
All right. Thank you. Well, it's an important question, but not an easy one to answer. And certainly in my years in Mexico, we tried to use every avenue we could find to spread knowledge about the value of the relationship between the two countries. One thing we tried to do working with the Mexican Foreign Ministry was expand the number of student exchanges, for example. It was amazingly low, the number of Americans studying Mexico, the number of Mexicans studying the United States, given the proximity and the size of our economic relationship. But we had to turn to foundations and the private sector to fund this because there wasn't a lot of government money available. There was some Mexican government money available for a couple of years, but there was never any U.S. government available. But we did expand very significantly the number of university-to-university programs. We sent a lot of Mexican students up for a couple of months to come to the United States. And the idea was, if you spend time in the other country, you come to understand it better. Two, if you're in the other country and you see these hardworking students come, they work hard, they go back home, you understand them better. So I think, just as you were down there recently on an exchange program, anything we can do to encourage the more organized citizen-to-citizen exchange helps reduce all those myths about just criminals come to the United States, or this is dangerous, all these people trying to get in. There are certainly those problems, and we need to admit them and talk about them, but as Ambassador Gutierrez said, if we're seeing them as a shared responsibility to deal with the problems and a shared responsibility to take advantage of the opportunities that are there, there's a tremendous amount that we can do. We would try to use social media on a regular basis to highlight the different things that were taking place in a positive manner as well. And I think we can do more of that. And as the ambassador said, for a number of years, a lot of us thought that the government of Mexico should be more active in traveling and going to different parts of the country to explain what was involved in this relationship with our southern neighbor. And we should certainly try and do that in Mexico as well.
Well, thank you very much. We are out of time. Those are excellent and inspiring comments to conclude our conversation for today. The U.S.-Mexico relationship is a relationship between two families, one family that is challenged, but at the same time, it is a family, so we will have many conversations. We will all thank you for your remarks today, but I also want to add our Brookings thanks for your leadership, ambassadors, both of you, for working in the interests of the United States, in the interests of Mexico, and integration, you when you were ambassador, you as an ongoing ambassador, and also during the past several weeks and months, explaining the relationship to the U.S. public, honestly analyzing and presenting the relationship. So thank you both, sirs, and please join me in thanking the ambassadors.